Remember if we've ever met before. We may have at some point. Lisa O'Connor.
Hi, Lisa.
And I'm your alum.
Oh, yay.
And you know what? Never ask me for money.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Bad.
Oh.
Or brought me back to campus for a reason.
Really?
So.
Are you on our alumni list, sir?
I don't know. I guess probably not. But I want to be, and I want to get, and I love my well, alma mater.
We're trying
so.
To love our alumni too, so.
Yeah, so.
Apologies.
I expect that'll change some. So, I'm thankful to have my undergraduate degrees from there. I grew up in Columbia.
Oh,
yeah. I graduated with my MLS in 96. So everybody I know is gone.
Well, yeah.
Practically.
It's changing. We're going to probably within 5 years have at least 3/4 of the faculty will be in that 5 years. So.
That's where we are, too.
Yeah. We just brought April over, so that was a good picture.
We're going to have 50% turnover in the next 3 years just from retirement.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Interesting time to hear.
I'd love to come to this.
Well, we will make it happen. That would be fantastic. Thank you for the offer.
Yeah.
Now,
speaking old hat for you?
I do a lot of it.
Yeah.
So I'm you know, sort of I consider it a inverted introvert. You know, the more people, the more comfortable I am. So.
Wow.
From the group of 10, I'm so good.
Yeah, this is a good group of people, good mix. Very interesting. Looking forward to it.
So I imagine a pretty healthy representation from Charlotte Mecklenburg.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if we got any school librarians this year because it's so difficult for them. A lot of academics. A lot, probably more public than academics.
So how's life at UNC Charlotte?
It's going pretty well. We have almost all our positions, you know, because people leave. We recruit and we haven't gotten any new positions lately, and we haven't heard about the budget for next year.
Yeah.
We're also hoping we'll get some last-minute one-time money to help pay for the monographs. we're with YBP. We have a deposit account. We're like $35,000 in the hole.
Oh.
Plus what we're going to have this month. So I told my dean, I said, we need $75,000 by the end of the year, or we'll just sort of ride.
Right.
If they don't cut us off, then we'll get money at the end of the year.
Yeah. Roll it over.
Yeah.
Checking out the competition in their marketing.
Thank you.
times in the rentals.
Oh, very good.
I rotate off and on the board a couple times for Metro Atlanta. Got this big conference we have started 13 years ago, actually. But yeah, we're really glad to have you.
Oh, thrilled to be here.
This was a big thing when the board found out that you would be willing to come and everything. It was just a lot of excitement. So.
Well, I need to know my neighbors, so I'm always willing to get to where I need to be. So
Gianni, you had the USC LIS program, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I teach also for the UNCG LIS program for 10 years. It's pretty great. We used to have a UNCC classes, and then they went full distance. And the program sort of took a dip for a little while, and now it's back up. We're getting some pretty good students.
Oh, yeah. Everyone had that lovely economic downturn. Right. Hit us, so, yeah.
But,
well, good.
But now I'm experiencing on the other end at Johnson & Wales, where our numbers are not there.
No?
Yeah, we kind of managed to go through all those tough times. Now, all of a sudden, nobody seems to really be able to quite figure it out, but we're maybe the less popularity of the culinary, which is our biggest program. We were looking at, we built the budget originally on 750 students coming in the fall, and now they're telling us it's like 550.
Oh.
So we're trying to we're trying to get rid of pigs.
Oh, man. Well,
thanks for coming.
Oh, pardon me. My pleasure. It won't be the same thing.
Perfect. All right. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I'll let you walk. I want to step in with your time.
Fair enough. I'm here at your disposal.
So we have Rear Interiors, EBSCO,
is over on this side, and UNC Greensboro is the table right here, and hopefully we'll see SpringShare and Rittenhouse Book Distributors. And obviously without their contributions, this conference wouldn't be possible. So we appreciate them. let's see, lastly, just a couple of housekeeping items. The restrooms are at the end of this hall, and the breakout rooms are cypress and birch along this wall, and ash is across from the registration desk, and I'm missing one. Maple, yeah, sorry. So there are two here and two outside on either side of the registration desk. So this year I had the pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. David Lankus. Dr. Lankus is the director of the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and recipient of the American Library Association's 2016 Ken Haycock Award for Promoting Librarianship. His book, The Atlas of New Librarianship, won the 2012 ABC Clio Greenwood Award for the best book in library literature. Dr. Lankus is a passionate advocate for libraries, librarians, and their essential role in today's society. So, Dr. Lankus, let's welcome.
Thank you, sir. All right, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm now officially a Southerner because I've been here for 10 months. It's very interesting, Ron will attest to the fact that every so often I've had bumps in the road. I once proudly declared that I had acquired a smoker, which I was told in no uncertain terms was in fact a propane oven, good try. So I'm doing my best. I've got a few bless your hearts and things going on. Honestly, coming down from New York, it's been an adjustment to try and get rid of some of the baggage that's associated with New York. But the one piece of baggage that I have yet to get rid of, and I kind of don't want to, is the fact that I come from an empire state, and that idea of building empires is kind of enjoyable to me. So that's what I'd like to talk about today. So my colleagues from Greensboro do not have to be worried that the title of a Carolina school does not mean that I'm out to try and take over and acquire them all, but something different. What I'd like to talk to you about today is an opportunity that I see. It's an opportunity that drew me here in the first place, that brought me down to see what amazing things are happening in librarianship throughout this region. The great libraries, the great librarians, the great academics, the great schools, the great scholarship. And I see someplace that we can go. And so today, what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to make you a proposal. I want to talk about how we can really build within North Carolina a new school of librarianship. Not a school as an organizational structure. No, not another academic institution. No, no more committee meetings. But really the idea of a school of thought. And if you've ever heard of this phrase, you've probably heard of things related to such as the Chicago School. So the Chicago School, there's the Chicago School of Architecture. And it doesn't mean that it's an academic department. What it means is at a very pivotal time in Chicago's development, right after it was sort of burned to the ground, and as new technologies were coming up, a bunch of thinkers and architects got together and said, we could do something interesting. We could do something different. We could do it and we could ground in philosophies, theories, new ideas. They were sort of breaking out of the Frank Lloyd Wright idea and starting to think about how do we rebuild our city? How do we think about it? This is, at the time, a skyscraper. And the skyscraper was first made available because they moved to steel construction. Up until that point, it was a lot of bricks and plaster. And now with steel, they could begin to talk about how we could build taller and taller buildings. And when we build taller and taller buildings, and we now had elevators, so we didn't have to walk up all those stairs, what should they look like? What does that make sense? And so, once again, through informal connections, through formal connections, through projects, through trying it, they really came up with a new way of thinking about architecture, what today we call modernism. But that concept of the Chicago School of Architecture changed the way that our cities looked. That remember that Manhattan in the 1800s did not look like the Empire State Building. It did not look like these modern buildings. Chicago at the time didn't have massive skyscrapers, and so they really got together and invented it. And what they did in Chicago spread then to the entire world. And it's really important to understand that ideas are real. And I know that sounds sort of odd, but let me work on that for a moment. Ideals. If people have a shared idea, a common value system, a common vision, a common thought, it really does shape reality around it. There wasn't a bunch of people who got together and said, okay, we're going to form a school of thought. This is what it looks like. It's going to have this architecture. Go. It was through ongoing discussion, but then working together, building together an idea. An idea that construction should be simplistic. An idea that we should be utilitarian, etc. And it shaped the world that we live in. If you go down to downtown Charlotte, that started by a bunch of people in Chicago going, what should these things look like? Now that we can make 20, 30-story buildings, God forbid, 100-story buildings, what does that mean to life? One of the really interesting discussions is not only did this have implications for architecture, it turned into organizational design. Suddenly, organizations, corporations, banks, businesses, could get bigger in terms of what they did and their impact and their number of employees because they could suddenly centralize their staff. They could suddenly put hundreds of people together, and before telecommunications, before the idea of everyone walking around with a cell phone, the idea that they could be together and communicate allowed them to think bigger and broader, etc. So even when they started with something like, if we change how buildings are built, they didn't say, we will therefore create global monopolies of companies to steal our information in Facebook. But unintended consequences happened. But it began with a shared idea. They did it again. Chicago apparently was very busy. They rethought economics. And the one that I've lived through, and if you have been through library school, have had to live through, was really the Chicago School of Social Science. That when they looked at research and data and how we study people, began with literally the University of Chicago looking at rural sociology, they said, we can't just go and do a bunch of surveys, and we can't like pull all of Chicago into a lab and hook electrodes to their head and hope for the best. And so they began to think about different ways of studying people. And they developed ethnographies. They developed the idea of going in and grounded theory. And they very much changed how we do research today. When I started my doctoral program way in the ancient days of 1992, that idea is, oh, you must have, there've got to be sigmas somewhere. If you don't have Greek letters and operands in your dissertation, you're not doing real science, right? As one of my colleagues said, if you're doing qualitative research, what you're doing is very, very slow reporting. And the Chicago School really said, no. This is the only way to understand very human activities. I'm looking at some of the poster sessions, and I'm looking at how some of the data was gathered, talking to people, observation, etc. That very much was influenced by the Chicago School of Social Science. So when I talk about building a Carolina school, what I'm not talking about, once again, is an academic institution with a faculty sitting someplace. I'm talking about how we can really come together and build an idea. An idea that influences not only the lives of library users, patrons, members here, and librarians, but truly globally shapes how we think about the field. And that's the level of opportunity that I think we're standing in front of. So what I want to talk about today, this is my agenda for the day, is first of all, why the Carolinas? Why North and South Carolina? Why wouldn't this happen somewhere else? After all, we've had schools of thought in librarianship before. And as someone who came from New York, I'm very familiar with them. Right? It's Melville Dewey. And so think about this. A crazy religious zealot who's a misogynist and an anti-Semite changed how libraries work around the world. I think we can do better. Many people don't talk about that with Dewey, but you know, there's a reason cookery's in business, and there's a reason that you know all the religions are here, you know, etc. So why the Carolinas? Then I want to talk about this power of sort of a school of thought. How an idea can become a reality. I want to give you my thoughts about sort of foundational concepts of what would constitute part of that, sort of as a platform for it, and then talk about next steps of where we can go. And I'm hoping, if I do this right, we'll have time to ask some questions, make some arguments, make some deals. It'll be good. So, why the Carolinas? Why the Carolinas is interesting because if you go back to Chicago, why was it Chicago? And a couple of things are in common. First, a wealth of talent. Much of it sitting in this room. Yes, this is my way of trying to endear myself to the audience. But this is not, you know, without precedent. I mean, Charlotte-Mecklenburg County Public Library has always been seen as an instrumental library in public and community service. Right? Richland County Public Library just won the IMLS Medal. Right? North Carolina State University has always been seen as an extraordinarily progressive academic library. We have folks in Greensboro who are looking at school libraries, and we have people in Chapel Hill that are looking at things that people in Chapel Hill look at. He's magnanimous in Greensboro, not so much in Chapel Hill. But no, we have the academic library direction. We have the idea of what it takes to do leadership and management. We have the influence in social media and archives. We have amongst us archives that do incredible work in the history of this region. So we have an amazing pool of talent. This isn't a matter of coming in and saying, well, you guys have been doing nothing for the past centuries, but now we're going to start. We have already been shaping the world this way. Can we bring it together and maximize that impact? We have regular connections. I mean, once again, Metrolina. Here's a group that are getting together on a regular basis. We have South Carolina Library Associations, North Carolina Library Associations. We have lots of common networks. Even in the academic environment, you have the idea of it's not just the University of South Carolina in Columbia, but in Lancaster and in Aiken and in Union. And same thing in North Carolina and Charlotte, Greensboro, et cetera. We have networks that we can build upon. So we're connected. We talk. We have a growing area of geographical importance. Once again, one of the reasons I moved down here is because I once made the joke that living in Columbia, I actually live in Lexington outside of this, kind of like living in Sim City. You know, in Syracuse, we were used to driving by, you know, the empty warehouse, and the next day you drive by and it was an empty warehouse. In 5 years, you drive by and it was an empty warehouse. Here, I drive by, and it's like this lovely little farmhouse with trees all around. And the next day, the farmhouse is on steel girders. And the next day, it's clear cut, and then like a week later, boom, there's a mall. Right? I'm living, and my house was built from a concrete slab to me moving in 60 days. That, to me, is miraculous. And luckily, it's not falling down yet. I'm not sure I trust it completely, but this idea of, we know that the Southeast is a growing region. We know the trend lines. We know that people are moving into this area. We know that economic activity is being built up. We see industry coming in. We see lots of opportunities. And there, we live in a time of what I call important disciplinary pressures. What does that mean? We've gone through the fear and loathing phase of librarianship, right? In the early 2000s, Google was going to put us out of business. And then it was databases are going to, you know, all this is going to put out of business. We're now at a time when we see article after article and things like the New York Times and the Washington Post National leading things talking about the resurgence of libraries. We see a lot of new opportunities going on in libraries. But we also see areas and societal pressures that make librarianship, and I use that very broadly, not just people with LIS degrees, but people in the field. I have a very simple test for whether you're a librarian. If you get hit by a bus in the morning and the library can't open, librarian. Right? We see areas that are in our field, that are our strength, that are in crisis. We see an assault on the idea of rationality and scientific information. We see an assault on fake news. We see a discussion about communities being pulled apart ideologically. We see economic development. All the things that librarians for a long time have taken under the aegis of information literacy, literacy in general, we see that this is a time when, as a country, we are being asked what is true. As a country, we are being asked to say what is a community. As a country, we're being asked to say, what does it mean to be authoritative? We had an FBI director announced via Twitter. I'm not here to tell president jokes, but I can. This is a time when people are looking around and they're asking one of the most fundamental questions from Library Science 101. What is an authority? If we don't answer that question, if we don't step up and have that discussion, if we're not seen as important in that discussion, then we put ourselves on the sideline. And we deserve to be overlooked. We need to talk about the core of what we do. We're seeing as people are migrating and moving information. I was just having a lovely conversation about the fact that we don't live in a paperless world. My mortgage is probably sitting in a piece of paper somewhere, and I kind of worry about it. But we live in an era when, as we move more and more to digital media and such, what do we do with the paper? Are we going to create a dark ages of information? We also live in a fabulous world where, rather than people forgetting their history, we now live amongst our history in a way that has never happened before. Think about that for a moment. Much of human society for thousands of years has been taking what they can remember, what they can put in their head, and move forward. And whatever didn't get captured, whatever didn't get collected, disappeared. We now have a point where if I took a video of my son's third birthday where he's hopping in a bouncy castle, that's available to click through YouTube. We are now amongst our history in a way that we've never been before. Why in the world does my 17-year-old son want to play Nintendo games? They sucked when I played Nintendo games. I mean, I look at the most modern games and it's like 3D, shaping, virtual reality. I mean, I sound like that old, get off my yard. But anyway, you know, ray traced, incredible realism, and it'll turn that off and they'll bring up Super Mario bouncing around. Why? Because they can live and embrace the history in a way that I couldn't. Being nostalgic in the 70s was in your head or a slide reel. Being nostalgic now means you're a click away from seeing what lives were like, what music was like, etc. And so as a culture, in our cultural heritage mission, how do we live in that world? How do we deal with reframing, rethinking, and refocusing? How do we know what to capture? But once we capture it, how do we sort through that world? These are fundamental, important questions. I was at a wonderful humanities event, and a filmmaker was getting, a civil rights activist, a filmmaker was getting an award, and he talked about, as a native South Carolinian, he talked about the lover's quarrel with his heritage. And it's remarkable, once again, moving down from New York, but to talk about living where you are both proud to be from the South, and in some ways very embarrassed, and sometimes very ashamed to be from the South, if you look through our history. That conversation about how we live with our heritage, how we live with the history, how we see the opportunities through race, through gender, as we see that, that's a conversation that, as librarians, we can be a part of, and is, I don't want to say unique to South Carolina, but certainly in my experience has been unique. I go to a university, I work at a university, where the first building built has a chaplain, and we do graduation every year. That building was built by slave labor. After the Civil War, that building was transformed into a normal teaching school for African American men and women to help them become teachers to teach throughout the New South. The day after Reconstruction, the new governor of South Carolina closed the university, reopened it a year later with completely new leadership as a white-only, male-only institution. It was 83 more years before the first African-American joined the University of South Carolina. I tell that story because, one, it strikes me as an important story, but I tell that story because a lot of the rights that we as a society take for granted can be taken away. That certainly the African Americans who were joining the normal school after the Civil War thought this was it, and it was taken away. We represent one of the few remaining civic organizations that work from womb to tomb and across the civilization, from higher education to K-12 education to public to special to medical to law. We are unified and can talk about how we preserve those rights. These are big issues. And I think that within South Carolina, we can be the people who help shape that world. And we can show the rest of the world how to have that conversation. So let's talk about the power of a school of thought. And I want to give one that you probably hadn't thought about. But I want to start with this fellow, which is his Claude Shannon. Claude Shannon was a mathematician, electrical engineer, worked at Bell Labs in the early 20s and 30s, and just died in the early 2000s. And Claude Shannon, if you ever have heard of him, you may have run into this. I always, once again, like to show Greek symbols because it pretend that I'm intelligent. I have no idea how to do this. This is an equation that he developed, and it's based on what he calls information entropy. He was trying to solve the problem of, as people in telecommunication working for Ma Bell back in the day when it was a monopoly, how can I get phone calls from one place to another when the farther away the phone calls are, the more interference, electrical interference you get? How can I filter out that information? And Claude Shannon developed this information theory, and it began rolling and rolling, because what he began to say was, how do we encode messages so that we can decode them on the other side? Rather than thinking of them as electrical impulses and waves, how do we think of them as bits? In fact, he invented the term bits. That's Claude Shannon. And he used this word information. Actually, the original paper he published was called Communications, but everyone began talking about information. This idea of how we encode things, this basic idea began things like encryption and encoding. During World War II, trying to figure out how to break encryption came from this equation. Because it goes something like, when you have the realm of possible messages, as you add more data to it, you restrict the possible messages, and therefore you can begin to efficiently encode them. Right? And so this is also, for example, the same type of equation where you could listen to music, and instead of dealing with these lovely waves, you could sample it every so often, compress it, turn it into bits, and play it back, which is how a CD works. But these days, how any digital media works. This is the basis of digitization. Now, this school of thought, once again, Shannon was not the only person to have it, and he did not spring from the head of Zeus. He was part of a whole group dealing with this. He sat down with people like Turing, and he sat down with people, he worked next to Einstein and such, and they all fought around this, but he's the one who crystallized it. And this thought that the world is information, because believe it or not, at the turn of the 20th century, people didn't use the phrase information the way we used it. Information was sort of this informal thing rarely used. He began to say everything's information. As people looked at this equation and began looking at what they could do through computing later, but even before computing, what could we digitize? What could we put this information? How could we build systems? Everything became information. Today in psychology, we think of the brain as an information processor. You have inputs and you think about this way, and if there's a dysfunction, take this pill and it'll come out right. Physics began talking about information. Psychology, sociology. Even today, economics, we talk about distributed information processing more than we talk about power and government. But there's an implication to this. In our field, changed because of information. Think about for a moment, how many times do you use the phrase information in a day? What do you do? I'm a librarian. What do? I provide information. I inform people. I organize information. I catalog information. I distribute information. We have become an information profession. Now, one of the issues, and back to the school of thought, the problem is when everything is information, you probably, if you live through a library science program, when everything is information, nothing in particular is information. Right? So a lot of the I schools built up around this idea that we are important, we are going to prepare people because they're the information professionals. You as librarians have a whole new lease on life because you're now information professionals. Because you can work in banks and you can work in law. The problem is that as everything became information, other disciplines such as sociology, such as my sister's school at Carolina, journalism, began adapting it. They began saying, all journalism is information. This is what journalism information looks like. And this is what sociology information looks like. And this is what physics information looks like. And so what's left for people in the information professions is that we are sort of the leftover soft middle. Where do we go with this? What is it truly that we can contribute that hasn't been incorporated in other disciplines? And the ultimate version of this, where we see this, is now we call it data science. And the concept is, if you give me enough data, I can shape the world. So there's a wonderful story. I love this story. Target. Yay. Target wants to own your shopping, right? They do a pretty good job of it. They got a cute dog. It's lovely. Target looked and they said, we know that, for example, women in this range control a huge amount of buying power. And it turns out that women change dramatically their shopping every so often, rarely, like two or three times. And one of the times that women, and you're wondering why I keep putting on women, is this a Dewey misogynist? Stick with me for a moment. One of the times in their data, in their study, that women change their shopping behavior is when they are pregnant. Suddenly, they start buying vitamins. Suddenly, organic becomes really much more important. Suddenly, they change how they're buying their food, they're buying their clothes, they buy different things. This is a time. And Target said, if I can identify and capture when a woman gets pregnant, and I can see them with tons and tons of advertising and get them coupons and et cetera, and so that when they change their habits, so instead of shopping in Kmart and Walmart, now they're shopping in Target, I've captured them because, once again, rarely do they have such a drastic change. Lovely. So Target puts all this lovely data in. And if you've ever shopped at Target, you are a piece of data, right? Would you like to use your shopping card, your Target card? Click, I now know where you bought it, what you bought, when you bought it. Oh, I'll be sending you an email. Did you even look at the email? Click, I know that you've seen it. Now I can figure out if you've actually cashed it in. They crunched this data. And they started, and they identified this one individual, and they started sending this one individual tons and tons of ads, tons and tons of coupons. It turns out this individual was a 16-year-old girl living at home. Father suddenly sees all these coupons for diapers and baby creams, and marches down to his local Target and says, "What are you people doing? You're trying to encourage my daughter to get pregnant." Turns out his daughter was pregnant. Just hadn't told him yet, right? Now the question is that a good thing? We'll come back to that question in a moment. But what I think about this is, if we throw enough data, we can do interesting things. Now, this has turned into a whole idea of digitization and algorithms and artificial intelligence to the point where, if you haven't seen it yet, you will see at some point we have predicted the doom of librarianship. Probably saw this on NPR, you've heard this, right? There is 64.9% chance as a librarian that your job will be replaced by a robot. Congratulations. I always find it interesting because it turns out there's only a 4.2% chance that software developers will be replaced. Gee, I wonder who did the study. Anyway. And if you take an information data view of the world, they may not be wrong. If all the world is about crunching data and feeding data and putting in data and information, if we can predict what people want to read without actually talking to them by what they've read before, which is what Amazon's trying to do, why do we need librarians? If we can understand the services they need by looking through this, capture their database, et cetera. You live in a world where AI has become the golden solution to truth, right? By the way, I'm perfectly willing to share this because it turns out, as a university professor, only a 3.2% chance. I guess AI doesn't know how to sit on their butt. Anyway, as soon as they teach an AI to be pretentious, I'm out of there. I also think it's interesting because if I'm a college professor of librarians, does that mean that I'm teaching AIs? Anyway. But for a moment, this is having very interesting implications. And it's going to lead us to what we need to think about with this school of thought. Because one of the things that we've done is, at the University of South Carolina, we have a relationship with IBM. IBM creates, runs, maintains Watson. You probably first became aware of Watson because Watson won Jeopardy. Right? Well, now if you've seen the ad during tax season, HR Block is going to run your data through Watson, right? In the old days, it was, don't do it yourself, give it to a professional because they are more trustworthy. Now it's, don't do it yourself, give it to a computer because it is more trustworthy. Mm. IBM is desperate to find vertical markets, areas in which they can implement Watson, new areas of funding, new areas of revenue. And one of the areas, and one of the reasons that they worked with University of South Carolina is they were looking not simply as getting professors to help automate the rest of the world, they were kind of interested in how they could automate professors. And so they worked with nursing. It turns out that nursing education, and by the way, I know I have folks in here who are probably much more familiar with nursing education, so I apologize if I'm oversimplifying this. But much of nursing education is pretty regularized. That is, there's a standard set of curriculum, there are good competencies, and there's testing along the way to allow you to advance to the point of certification. So IBM began looking at this and they said, well, if we have a curriculum that says first you do this, then you do that, then you do this, we can automate that. And if you already have the content, we can show the content. Here's a video, here's a reading, here's a test, here's a quiz. And if we can begin to capture performance data on that, how well did they do on the quiz based on what they looked at, we can begin to do machine learning algorithms to do things like, it turns out that when I gave you a lot of video, you did well on the test. When I gave you a lot of text, not so much. Therefore, I'm going to give you more video. It turns out that you seem to like this kind of learning over this kind of learning. And if you'll think about, for my academic colleagues in the room, how much time do we spend on accreditation coming up with specific goals, outcomes, measurable, deliverable? How much have we really created an environment in higher education where it is now ripe for automation? Where it is now that point where we almost, as instructors, feel like robots filling out, where do they fit on the rubric, how do we know, how can I prove it, et cetera. And so IBM Watson began thinking, we could begin to do education without the faculty. Now, what I want to point out is that when we look at things like higher education, we think we're safe. Education, that's fundamentally human. But not if we don't approach it that way. And librarianship, we're safe because we deal with knowledge and how people learn. Not if what we're doing is providing them with regularized content. This example, this school of thought that changed the way the world looked at, and I'm not sure we're terribly thrilled where we're headed with it, we need to talk about a new vision. We need to talk about a vision where librarians and information scientists and information students are not purveyors of data and information. Because the one thing that they can't teach, that Watson can't teach at this point, is bedside manner. What they can't teach is, you've just given, you know, this doctor has just said so-and-so has a terminal condition. What now? We can show you a video on it. You can go to YouTube, how to deal with grieving family. Go. But that's different than walking and sitting and saying my experience and how I look at it. That's different about compassion. And so when we look at librarianship, we also have to ask that question, what do we do, what do we provide, what is our school of thought around this? Because once again, let me take you back 10, 15 years in LIS education. How much of LIS education was to attempt to create robots out of students? You're nodding, hopefully you didn't go to South Carolina, but... When you do a reference transaction, thou shalt never ask why you need to know this. You shall be unbiased and neutral. You shall walk someone to the resource, point to the resource, and ne'er shall they turn a page unless you bias them and you walk away. When we look at materials and such coming in, don't worry, we can copy catalog the hell out of it. Because Harry Potter is the same in Charlotte and Colombia and Zimbabwe and Australia. Don't worry, we can put machine learning through so that we can do faster Boolean queries and such. We're now busily replacing all those wonderful systems that do ands and ors with simple boxes that says, search for stuff, good luck. Right? The discovery layer is our attempt to be like Google. Yes, Google is attempting to be a world without a librarian. Think about this for a moment. Why does it work? Reason it works in Google is because what you have is this amazing network where people said this is related to this with hyperlinks, this is important, and this is that. And what we have in libraries is we have here's a document, here's a document, here's a document. No wonder it doesn't work. Where's the people? A group of librarians in Oregon were talking with teens because they wanted to improve teen services, and they said to these teens, what do you want from your librarians? The teen said, we want librarians to blog. To which the librarian said, what? You really want to read 50 entries of, the copier's broken again, the copier's broken again. Oh God, the bathroom, oh God. But as they began interviewing, they began talking to the librarian, talking to the teens, what the teens really, really, really wanted was Reader's Advisor. They wanted to know what was the next cool book. But rather than saying, this is what the New York Times thinks, or this is the reading list that came out of the state library, they wanted to know, who the hell are you? Do I like you? Do I agree with you? Do I disagree with you? Do you seem like someone that's interesting? Do you read the same kind of stuff? They wanted a relationship with libraries, with their librarians, with people. And relationships don't work really well in artificial intelligence. Now, to be very clear, My goal here is not to find that last little crumb after AI has taken over the world that we can hold to. Rather, it's to embrace artificial intelligence, machine learning, technology, to do the things that we no longer have to do so that we can focus on the things that are most crucial and important to our communities. And that means that the shape and nature of the Carolina school that we need to develop must be founded on meaning and knowledge, not on data or information. Stop telling people that you're in the information business. Start telling people you're in the knowledge business. Your job is not to inform, your job is to educate. Your job is not to overwhelm and provide lots of stuff, your job is to filter and provide the right stuff. The key to knowledge, the key to learning, is not accumulating more things and handing it off. It is actually to identify context and to provide less, but more relevant. We have to begin to embrace things. For example, information literacy. The key to information literacy is not education. The key to information literacy is an embrace of ignorance. What? So we've done lots of studies in information literacy. We bring in students, undergraduate students, we bring in people in public libraries, we give them a test and say things like, how would you find this? And the answer is Google. And how would you find this? Google. And how would you find this? Google. And then we give them an hour-long session. We teach them, no, Google's great, but there's this and this, and you've got to worry about credibility, and here's a crap test. And at the end, we walk them through and they do a test and it says, how do you find information? Google. How do you find information? Google. How do you find information? Google. But the one thing is, on the pre-test, we ask them, how confident are you in your ability to find quality information? And their answer is something like, you know, 8 out of 10. At the end, when we do the test and find that there's been no difference in their ability, they say 10 out of 10. What we do with a lot of information literacy is we increase people's confidence without increasing their ability. The only time we see where we increase people's ability is when we get them to think skeptically, when we get them to embrace that I don't know something. And this is true to the point where, as human beings, we are truly, truly disturbed and horrible species. And one of the reasons we know that is if someone has a false idea and you present the correct information to them, they will double down on the false idea. Climate change is there is no such, what is it? Climate change is a Chinese hoax. Sorry, just taking a moment. All right. No, look, 99% consensus among the scientific community. Here's the data that shows increased storm. Here's the data, climate change is a hoax by the Chinese. It's really, really bad now. That idea of simply saying to someone, you're wrong, here's the right answer, actually gets them to be more wrong. It is only when you can convince them that they have doubt, that they don't know, that they begin to think about, how could I know? How could I learn? How could I accept it? And now this is really not always fun, because what we're asking to do is turn an entire generation of people into skeptics. But we are kind of trying to turn an entire generation into skeptics. And we know this because, once again, every crap test, everything that we provide is on its head. Where do you go to get authoritative information on government policy? Where do you go to get authoritative information on presidential initiatives? It is not from the president. That's a change. How do we address that? How do we work with our community? How are we part of it? We need to be about knowledge and meaning and context and teaching people to embrace this world, right? So a couple of things. Let me break these down a bit. So the Carolina School of Librarianship, the thought that we can put together, that we can begin to formulate, that we can send to the world and show to the world how librarians are more important than ever, how libraries are more fundamental to society than ever before, and how we get more resources to do our job. Knowledge is uniquely human and constructed. Stop talking about the fact that you archive knowledge. You do not. The books, the materials, the databases, the maps, the images, the pictures, the archives, they are not knowledge. They're the product of knowledge, but they are not knowledge itself. I know this. The reason I know this is if you take a three-year-old and you put them in a really great public library and you lock them in overnight and you come in the next day, they will not know how to read. They will probably know how to climb and throw things, but not read. This idea that somehow these are magical and mythical things, that back to that information world, that we can simply encode what people know and then they can decode it on the other end. What Claude Shannon said with the information perspective, what his goal was to take a message, encode it, and recreate it as exactly stated on the other end. Here's the problem. Human minds don't work that way. What happens is I have a thought. I encode it in words and writing, whatever. It goes into your head. You sit there and go, bull, and it goes right out of your head. Or you say, that's right, or that's wrong, or what have you. Why do we have an education system? Because it's not as simple as saying we wrote it down and here it is. The materials, the things, the way that we collect, the way that we organize, they're important. They're essential tools. Let me be very clear. But they're not knowledge. It would be the same thing as saying that a surgeon is in the scalpel business. Now, clearly, when a surgeon does their job, they need a scalpel. But they're still a surgeon even if they don't have a scalpel. When the scalpel gets replaced by laser cutters and all this other wonderful technology, they're still surgeons. A librarian without a book, without a collection, without a building, still a librarian. Those are our tools, but we have other tools. These days, our tools look like this. The value that we provide is that we embrace our ignorance and are willing to share. So knowledge is human and it's constructive. Because that's the other thing. The thing that you hear, the thing that you know is unique to you. And you sit there and go, Dave, please. If you tell me that 2 + 2 = 4, I did not create that. That's not my idea. I think someone did it before me. But that's actually not true. How you understand 2 + 2 is very unique to you. How you learned it, where you learned it, what it made sense. And if you don't believe me, have a child in middle school and try and help them do their math homework. Dad, what's 10 divided by 2? 5. No, I need to, it's 5. No, I need to show. How do you know that? It's 5. I need to put it on a number line. Why? It's 5. Right? Pedagogical studies, learning theory has shown that, for example, the reason that we've changed middle school mathematics so far is that if people have a spatial relationship to numbers, they actually perform and can handle more abstractions. When I went to school, here's the thing, memorize it, good luck. I still, to this day, cannot do my 9s. 9 × 6, no clue. That's why I have a calculator. I mean, I don't do logarithms and exponents. I do 9 × 6. That's how pathetic I am at math. And so, this idea that 2 + 2 is somehow fundamental is not true. It's learned. We learn it. We learn it in different ways. We understand it. For example, did you know that big, fluffy, cumulus clouds in the sky weigh as much as 50 elephants? I do. I can even tell you how I learned it. I was listening to NPR one day at the corner of Jamesville and Tecumseh, and I heard it, and I looked up, and I said, oh, my God. Now, I did not do the calculation. I didn't get a scale in the sky and hope for the best. I didn't do that. Someone else clearly discovered it, but when I learned it, when it became part of my way of looking at the world, when it changed my perspective, now when I walk out and I see these huge puffy clouds, I'm like, oh my God, there's a bunch of floating elephants in the sky. Right? That's creation of knowledge. And a lot of it's shared. But even when we share these things, they're always going to have slight differences. And it's constructed through conversations. Now, sometimes a conversation with a professor or a colleague or a friend, most of the learning conversations we have are with ourselves. And if you ever find yourself going, what did he say? Who are you talking to? I don't believe that. Who are you talking to? Have you ever read a book and just out loud going, oh my God? Or, oh, that's horrible. Or, that's terrible. You talk to yourself all the time. Do I believe it? Don't I believe it? And think about for a moment, how many people have a favorite book? How many people reread a favorite book like 10 years later? And you ran into that
And suddenly the thought, the idea that you thought was central, was pretty much the entire book, was like a sentence in chapter 38. That's how we learn, how we connect, how we understand it. So when we work with our communities to make them more knowledgeable, to help them make smarter decisions, we have to understand that this is not a matter of shoveling more information into their brain. In higher education, you've heard the sage on the stage versus the guide on the side. The metaphor I always liked was buckets of knowledge. And that is that as a professor, I stand up here, and you are all empty buckets. And I am throwing bricks of knowledge, yes, bricks of knowledge, into your empty buckets. And unfortunately, some people's buckets are a little more narrow than other people's buckets. And sometimes when a brick of knowledge hits you on the side, it takes you out, right? But that's not how it works. It's not like you go to a filling station and go, law, sure, medicine, sure, it doesn't work that way. We discuss, we learn. So when we talk about how our communities can get better, how they can make smarter decisions, how they can live greater, more wonderful lives, how they can succeed in school, how they can succeed in business, how they can succeed in their law case, how they can better treat people, we have to understand that that is a knowledge exercise, not an information exercise. And what that means is we need to look at it as learning, where we build relationships, not transactions. When people come up to a reference desk and ask our questions, we like to think of that, here's a question, here's an answer, thank you, go away. We like to think of transactions, how many people walked into the building, how many people checked out a book, when they checked out a book, how fast and efficient it was. Transactions. We need to be in relationship business. When someone checks out a book, we need to understand that that is part of their larger world, whether it's because they had to check it out, they wanted to check it out, they're looking for something else. A reference transaction that may last 30 seconds is a class. It's a 30-second, highly individualized class with two people in it. And it's the same thing as standing up and doing instruction. And this idea of being unbiased and being neutral and not knowing who people are is garbage. Think about for a moment how transactions change to relationships. Here's a transaction. Someone walks up to a reference desk. How can I help you? Now we think of that phrase, how can I help you, as sort of the epitome of service, the thing that we really want to do. But I want you to think for a moment as that's potentially one of the most arrogant statements that you can make. How can I help you? Because clearly you need help. And we know that's not how it works. Sure, 9 times out of 10 it's the bathroom's over there, or no, we haven't found a USB drive. But for that 1 time out of 10 when someone comes and says, my favorite, do clams sleep? First we give them the statistical abstract to spend some time while we figure out what we're about to do. I don't know. Do clams sleep? A reference librarian once said that was her greatest question. It took her 20 years to get the answer. By the way, the answer, which came from a marine biologist, was, well, they go into a slightly more dormant phase. So. What if instead, because when people take the time to come up, yes, they may have simple questions, but it's part of a larger life. What are you learning today? What are you passionate about today? How can I be part of your learning? Now we're building a relationship as opposed to, what is your question? Here is the answer. Thank you, move on. You have checked out the book. Good luck. Not, you've checked out the book. Was it the right book? Can I get you another book? How did that work out? So, we need to talk about building relationships. And once again, I look at the opportunities we have in the Carolinas and I see example after example after example of how this is done well. This is not the scolding Dave Lankus, I promise. This is the in awe of you, Dave Lankus, that looks at how we have done things like hotspot loaner programs, how we have done things through archives and collections where people truly build books and new knowledge, when I look at customer service and how we do these things. That our school must be community-based and aspirational. That the ultimate success of our, call them patrons, call them customers, I call them members, as in members of community, whatever you call them, their success is how we get our success. And we're in good company. Doctors, for example, the success of a doctor is not how brilliant they are or how well they do on a test. It's whether you're healthy or not. Their success is defined in your success. Lawyers, it's not their knowledge of the law. It's your ability to get the client through their necessary step. Our abilities, our quality is always going to be measured in those that we help. Now, I say community-based, and oftentimes this is when every academic library goes, oh, it's a public library talk. No. An academy, a university, is a community. It's a community of scholars, of staff, of students. A law firm is a community of lawyers and paralegals and secretaries and lawyers. Community just means that we understand that we're in this together. A community has two parts. The first part is a known common variable. I work here, I live here, I study here. But the second, even more important, is they have some mechanism to distribute scarce resources. In a public setting, that might be real estate. Where does the new library go? Is this worth it? Or tax dollars. In higher education, it might be tuition dollars. Or it might be attention. Where do we spend time? Are we going to redo the entire curriculum? Is the core curriculum of the liberal arts going to be looked at? That's where we need to spend our time. So we need to be community-based. And this is the most important part. We must be proactive. Librarians actively weaving the community consensus. Here's the trick about fake news. It is not new. Its form is new. The way they make money off of fake news is new, right? It's advertising, much less about what the content is. But it's not new. We've always lived in a world of the National Enquirer. We've always had those opportunities. Right? You do it all the time. What's new is that fake news comes at a time when our communities are increasingly divided and looking for ways to further divide from themselves. There is less community consensus. When we talk about making America great again, what we're talking about is returning to a time, mythical, when everyone agreed on America being great and what it meant to be great. It agreed that we had the strongest military, that we had the best economy, that everyone had a job. We agreed that a time where political correctness didn't dictate our discussions. It ignores the idea that during that mythical time, it helped if you were a white man. It ignores the idea that where you lived changed that discussion. But it's this seeking a consensus. And the problem is that we, in our communities, whether they're academic communities, whether they're legal communities, physical communities, have less and less of a common consensus about the values that we hold dear. Education. Do you remember the days when you're, well, in my case, my parents would go and hope to get the teacher's approval? Now, as a parent, I show up and that teacher better get my approval. We've changed the consensus on education and the role of teachers. We've changed the consensus on what we see as a politician and what their role is. And I want to be very clear. We have and hold a responsibility in this. Because you're sitting there going, no, Dave, we are the solution. Yes, but you're also the problem. Mm-hmm. Libraries and librarians and information science and that information perspective is part of the problem that we helped create. You sit there and you go, huh? Once again, who are you talking to? Larger discussion. But if you read, how many people have heard the phrase information overload? How many people have heard information overload as a serious issue within the past 2 years? Why? Why is because we got together and said, there's too much information. As librarians, we're equipped to handle it. We can do it. But those poor, poor people out there, those poor, poor public out there, they're overwhelmed. Drinking from a fire hose. You can, I remember all the metaphors. They were lovely, right? What was our solution? Our solution as an library and information science community was actually pretty smart. Filters. We didn't call them filters. We called them profiles. We were going to build profiles of individuals. We were going to understand them deeply. So that you could go in and say, I'm interested in this topic and this topic and this topic, so that we can filter out the wrong things. This goes back to go to my tech services folks. When we talk about reduction of noise, right? We want to reduce the noise. As librarians, we want to get the stuff out of the way you don't need to only get to the stuff you need. It's brilliant. Google and Amazon and Bing and all the other folks, not Bing, I mean, who cares about Bing? Anyway. Though if Microsoft is listening, we could use a grant. Anyway. This work that we did was to say, we are going to figure out important salient features of your life, and we're going to get the information based on your important salient features. Right? We're going to provide a knowledge discovery lane. We're going to have an account with the library, and you can use this account to check out ebooks and such, and you can find your history, and you can do all this stuff. And we ran headlong in saying, information overload is such a problem. We need a solution. Great. We will build profiles. And Google does profiles based on where you are, what you searched before, what's in your email, and Facebook does it based on how they can get advertisements and steal your identity. It's lovely. But what Facebook does, what Twitter does, what Google does that we now yell at as filter bubbles, that we now say is separating people so you only have to talk to people you like, that allow people to have misshapen ideas and to only talk to other people, the thing that we lament is exactly the thing that we sought to build. We just didn't watch it all the way through. We built a tool that has been weaponized. And now we need to take that responsibility. And part of what we can do as librarians is not say, because once again, those filters are based on that, back to Claude Shannon's information entropy. That is an information perspective. You have an information problem, too much information. I have a solution, which is filters. Done. Not realizing that that information solution is feeding into someone's xenophobia, is feeding into someone's racism, that is feeding into someone's isolationism, that is feeding into someone's dysfunction, that is feeding into someone's isolation amongst themselves. If we look at an information perspective, we have a solution. If you take a knowledge and a meaning perspective, we have a problem. And it's a problem that is not going to be solved by Facebook changing their algorithm this much. I hate to break it to you, but our buddies at Facebook are not going to solve fake news by simply adding more news. It's going to take someone to sit down and say, you have this view, you have this view. We need to talk. And so when we look in our communities and we see what are the places, what are the people, where have the values that we can bring communities together to have very hard conversations in a safe place. Who doesn't come to libraries? It's not town hall. It's not the police station. It's not the parks. It's not even the academic departments. It's libraries. We're one of the few standing organizations that can bring people together and say, this is really hard. And we really are going to have a massive, mean, terrible conversation. But we're going to do it in a framework, in a place, in a method, of a facilitation that we can have honest conversations. And by the way, the end of that conversation may be agreeing to disagree, but we're gonna have it. No AI, no Watson, no bit of information, no document allows us to do that. That's what we can do. And one of the things that we have to talk about with, this is one very specific example, because Dave, you're 30,000 feet, help me. Richland Library, my library. One of my libraries. I have many libraries. One of my libraries. The Richland Library just won the IMLS Medal. Lovely. Well deserved. This is one of the parts of their strategic plans. So when they did the strategic plan, they didn't just sit in a room and say, all right, what's our strategic plan? We want a more literate community. We want people to read. They went out to the whole of the county and they sat with sheriffs. They sat with mayors. They sat with town councils. They sat with community reps and they said, what is the strategic plan of this county? And this is what they came up with. They said that the library shall help create a strong and resilient economy. That the library will strengthen community cohesion. That the library will transform educational outcomes for youth and will help break the cycle of poverty. Now we look at this, we say, what book are they going to check out that's going to do that, right? Or, that's not my job. Or, one organization can't do that. And you know what? You're right. And they know that. They know that the library is not going to break the cycle of poverty. But they do know that they can be a part of it. The Free Library of Philadelphia, large library, urban library, their central branch, which is down in Logan Circle, which is right here where Rocky ran up the steps. Right across from the library is a small park. And I was doing some work, so I showed up at opening hours. So I got there a little bit before 9, and the park was filled with people. They opened the doors, everyone went in. I thought, this is amazing. You probably know exactly where this is going, which is they were the homeless population, and they now had a place where they could find shelter and work. Now, what came with this, of course, is all the issues you have when you have a community without a home. The bathrooms have problems. Resources get used. Not everyone is comfortable in the setting. In fact, they have this world-renowned author series where they would bring in famous authors. And of course, all the gentry of Philadelphia would show up. And one time a trustee left because they had used the bathroom, went in and found the condition of the bathroom and said, this has to stop. And went to the librarians and said, you have a homelessness problem, fix it. So the librarians sent out, you look offended, wait, it gets worse. The librarians sent out a call to other urban libraries and say, how do you work with the homeless? How do you deal with this problem? And what's horrifying to me is the answers they got back were, how to enforce vagrancy laws. If you have any flat surfaces outside of your building, put up pigeon spikes to prevent them from having to sit and loiter there. How can you kick people out? In essence, the homeless problem was, the homeless are the problem. And what the librarians, to their great credit and to my everlasting love of them, said was, no, that is not the problem. Homelessness is the problem. And so what did they do? The first thing they did was they hired homeless men and women to be bathroom monitors. Okay, but they gave them some authority within it. The other thing they did is they built a cafe. And you're going, they built a cafe? Well, before that, they invited philanthropy groups, social service groups, to also meet in that park across from the library to do food donations and coat donations and services. But then they built this cafe. The cafe was funded by the Bank of America, a large corporation sitting in Philadelphia. The pastries for the cafe came from local bakers so that they weren't in competition with their own neighbors. The coffee came from Starbucks as a donation, and training came from Starbucks. And they staffed the cafe from a worklessness to work program run by a local religious charity. They did not solve homelessness in Philadelphia, but they didn't turn their back. They didn't say, no, we're the knowledge, we're the information people. You want to solve homelessness? Let's do a book report. They said, no, this is important. This is what we're going to do. So we must talk about how a school of librarianship that we're going to build is proactive, that it's not a matter of waiting to be asked. No one ever changed the world by waiting to be asked for help. We change it by going out into our community and saying, what are you wrestling with? What are you wrestling with? What is your area? What are you dealing with? So given those foundations, given the thought, what are our next steps? If we want to do this, if we want to come together and say, North and South Carolina, by having these conversations, by talking about our values, by talking about how can we change the world? Right? Because ultimately, that's what we want to do. We want to create an area where we can build and promote a narrative of the profession. What is the value of librarians in the days of Watson? What is the value of a library in an academic setting, in a community setting, in a law setting? Right? John Palfrey wrote a book called Bibliotech, highly recommended. He talked about the dangers of nostalgia. He says, nostalgia is this warm remembrance for the way that things never were. Think about it. Libraries are books. Why do you think that? Because when I was a kid, what that means is many people are basing their view of what a library is not simply on 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but the perceptions of a 7-year-old 10 and 20 years ago. What did they see? Did they worry about school readiness? Did they worry about economic opportunity? Did they worry about? No. We need a new narrative that talks about knowledge, community empowerment, being proactive, bringing our communities together. We need to provide a virtuous circle of research and development across library types. Example, libraries in times of crisis. So in Columbia, I came back, the year before me was the massive flooding. I've heard it 500 years, now it's 1,000 years. Flood inflation, I don't know. But we had faculty that went and they said, what's going on here? What's happening here? Turns out FEMA came and set up in public libraries because they were trusted spaces. The bookmobile got all the books pulled out and all the water put on so that they could provide fresh water. They began looking at how to teach people social media so they could find out where are the areas of need and where are the areas of help. It's an example of looking after Hurricane Matthew and the flooding that happened in North Carolina, the damage that happened in South Carolina, going and saying, how can libraries be helpful? For example, in the flooding, if you're walking through the water, that water not only just came down from the sky, it came out of the sewers, untreated. Let's give you some public health information. Let's talk about treatment. Let's talk about what's going to happen. Let's talk about the fact that a disabled man who was bound in a wheelchair, an electric wheelchair, sat in his house. And as the flood raged, it created a moat around his house so he couldn't leave. A moat, and this is why I love living in South Carolina, full of venomous snakes. Good Lord. Everything down here is going to bite you, kill you, or light you on fire. It's amazing. Anyway, when the rescue team came in their boat, they could not accommodate the wheelchair. They left. Luckily, the water didn't go further. Understanding what is the role of that? How can we coordinate those services? How can you be aware of universal design and access? How can you be aware of our community? How can we talk about the community that is majority and minority in terms of ableness and readiness? That's an example where we could be pulling together, where a public library could be working with Greensboro professors who can be working with an academic library who talks about what happened when we had to close down the space. Right? How can we build a system where we prepare people? Right? Provide a core of ready change agents. I love, you know, we're busy creating librarians. We do a fantastic job. Of course, South Carolina is the best job, but hey, we do a good job. But now that I look at the North Carolina State University Fellowship Program. How can we bring libraries and residents that will come into the Carolina area to learn and leave? How can we begin preparing a core for people who deal with issues of race, who deal with issues of disability, deal with scholarship, deal with preservation of information? How can we create a system where we're constantly studying? And so when you develop a brilliant thing in your library, you stand up and you have a mechanism to say, I did a brilliant thing in my library. Come look at me. Come study me. Or, I've got this problem, who else has this problem? Great, let's all put $1,000 in the pot and we can all look at this problem together. We can create a system where as a library community, we don't just come together twice a year in association. By the way, great thing to do. We'll get there, I promise. But on a daily basis, have a system of connection, of setting agendas, of pulling forward. Okay. How can we look at building a conversation where, because no one of us can do this alone. No college can do this. I would love to say that South Carolina has this handled. And I'm gonna do my best at the University of South Carolina to make sure I prepare the best librarians in the whole world. I really do. But I'm not gonna prepare every one of them. And I know that my company in Greensboro is gonna be doing the same. And every so often we have to compete. But more often than not, we need to work together. And we can't even do it because you know that you have people in your libraries that will never go to libraries. But they need to understand what's going on. When we hire, for example, we hire social workers now to work in our libraries. Do we ever give them an intensive library science 101 so they don't feel isolated, so they share common values and visions, so they understand us? When we look in academic libraries and we bring in our content specialists because they have PhDs in a given discipline, do we have a way of bringing them into the understanding of it's not just information, it's knowledge, it's enhancement, it's service, our values, teaching them what we think about how privacy works. Right? Project-based, where we have projects where we say, today, as a community, we are going to work on. I'll give you one that we need to work on right now. South Carolina is about to redo its LIS curriculum. One of the things I know we need to prepare librarians for is that they are the instruments of change within an institution. When we talk about moving from transactions to relationships, when we talk about, it's not just about answering a question and go away, or here's a book and go away. We talk about seeing, suddenly, it's more important about how do you think and who are you as a human being. Think about your LIS education. How much of it was focused on either them, the patron, user base, usability, or it, the books, the systems, the materials, the system, and how little of it was focused on you. How do you work in an environment of great stress? I saw one of those. Great. Right? That poster about helping, by the way, either you're welcome or I'm sorry, but that idea you know, bringing fun to the academic library. The reason that poster exists is because we haven't spent enough time in LIS education talking about the need for fun and talking about the need of mental health of the individual, of what do you believe and your values and how do you encounter the community. Because if we're going to get people from moving from behind the desk to in front of the desk, we need them to be confident as human beings. And I'll tell you, having developed that curriculum scares me to death. And what I need is I need the person who did that poster session, and I need the people who manages on a daily basis at Charlotte Mecklenburg, and I need people who work at Thomas Cooper Library, and I need people at Chapel Hill at NCSU to sit me and go, all right, this is what we had to put in place to prepare librarians to deal with people who have mental health conditions, the homeless. This is how we deal with arrogant professors who never listen. I talked to a great librarian, and he is a great librarian, and he talked about he's giving information literacy class, and he had this one student who was, you know, in traditional mode of an hour-long information literacy class. Next day, he comes to that librarian, the student comes to the librarian and goes, oh, I have to do a research report, I don't know how. And the librarian said, it took every fiber of my being not to say, well, if you were awake yesterday, you would have. How do we prepare people to do that? We like, number one, I ask people, all right, librarian directors, for my graduates, what are the number one skills you need? It's never, I need them to know RDA really well. I can't, if they understand the Dublin Core and how it's, you know, it's common sense. Communication skills, project management. How do we do that? And the answer is, I'm going to do my best. And maybe I'll go hire a faculty member who knows it. But I would much rather go walking through Charlotte, walking through Asheville, walking through Union, walking through whatever and saying, how do we do this? That every student who comes into South Carolina, that comes into Greensboro, that comes into Chapel Hill, gets assigned a mentor from a librarian in the field so that they automatically have a connection to experience and history in them. These are the kinds of things that we can do. A clearinghouse so that we share that knowledge once it happens, so that these posters don't disappear. And so that when people in Seattle and Syracuse and Zimbabwe want to know, how do you guys do it so well in Carolinas? They have a place to go and learn and understand that this institute, where we can pull it to our curriculum, you can pull it to your staff development, you can pull it to our new project on your archive, you can bring it into your special collections with annual reports. Because ultimately, what we're about, what we're trying to do, is we are trying to solve a grand challenge. We want to know, how do we coordinate this knowledge infrastructure of bits and bytes and target data, of ubiquitous connections, of people following us at Facebook and bugs. How do we coordinate a world where we're trying to figure out about net neutrality, we're trying to figure about monetizing information, where we're trying to figure out about public and private and the public sphere? How do we coordinate that infrastructure to enable our communities to make smarter decisions? Whether that's about where to do real estate, whether that's a curricular decision, whether that's what research to do, whether that's what law system to put in place. How do we do that? And I think that within the Carolinas, North Carolina and South Carolina, together, as people who have been dedicated to the best service, we have the ability to lead the world in answering that question. We have an empire to build. We have a school of thought. And I believe that all of you should be part of it. And I look forward to doing my small part to make it happen. Thank you very much.